The thing about fanatics is it's often the ones that love you the most that will turn and stick a knife right through you when you piss them off or disappoint them in some way.
That is the singer-songwriter Ani DiFranco reading from her new memoir, talking about the complicated relationship she has with very fervent fans.
It's a relationship between a projector and a screen. And as the screen, I've felt my humanity thoroughly erased many times. Women, especially, can be emotionally intense. The letters and gifts that came backstage, the portraits and paintings and jewelry, the signed books and demo tapes, the typed resumes and handwritten manifestas, the invitations for me and Andy to go to someone's house after the show for homemade lesbian porn and tea. It was all very sweet and funny until it wasn't.
DiFranco grew up in Buffalo, New York, and that's where she started her own label at age 19. First, just to distribute her own music, but now with other well-known artists, including Sarah Lee and Andrew Bird. The label is called Righteous Babe Records, which is sort of perfect because DiFranco is a fierce feminist and advocate for LGBTQ rights.
You were fresh off the boat from Virginia. New York City under my belt. We met in a plane, we were both 19. I remember where we were standing, I remember how it felt. Two little girls sprung out of their training bras. This little girl breaks furniture, this little girl breaks laws.
For going on 30 years, that righteousness has made DiFranco a hero to lots of women. But it also led a lot of her fans to have certain strong expectations. And they were quick to let her know when they felt betrayed, when, say, they thought she wasn't fighting the man hard enough, like when she married men twice. So connecting with fans but trying not to have them get too connected is something DiFranco writes about in her memoir. In a way, she's been dealing with how open she can or should be since she was a kid.
Yeah, it's funny because my mother, I think, had a vision of a family that was extremely intimate and open with each other. And the irony of the house I grew up in is that wasn't the vibe. It was one big open room on the first floor and one big open room on the second floor. People were very hidden from each other, and there was a lot that went unsaid. And so I think I was caught in this sort of paradox and have been exploring ever since the boundaries of privacy and intimacy and family and searching for an intimate relationship with people who see me and who I see in return. I search through music.
Squint your eyes and look closer. I'm not between you and your ambition. I am a poster girl with no poster. I am 32 flavors and then some, and I'm beyond your peripheral vision. So you might want to turn your head, cause someday you are gonna get hungry and eat most of the words you just said.
I was a teenager in the 80s. The culture, you know, was very Michael Jackson and Madonna. Just a lot of pop music and commercial, a real commercial thrust to the culture. And I was very into music as a thing to do, you know, not a thing to buy. I released my first cassette. It was just on cassette at first in 1990. And from that moment on, people came and found me. And it sort of opened up the world of touring nationally to me. So my gigs were still pretty humble. I was playing in cafes and coffee houses and, you know, student union cafeteria halls. But somehow, even way back in the day, there would be at least one or two or five people mostly young women who would come far to connect with the person who had made that tape. So I, you know, I started to find my tribe.
Looks me up and down, like he knows what time it is, like he's got my number, like he thinks it's his. He says, call me Mrs. DeFranco, if there's anything I can do, I say it's Mr. DeFranco to yell.
I came up in the world of folk music, which is one of many genres in which, you know, the lives of men are just more represented. You know, it's I've been working on the railroad and going off to war and, you know, these stories of men's lives. And so in that, like so many genres, I felt talking about my experiences as a female was sort of startling to people in song, and a lot of people kind of recoiled from it. A lot of people dubbed me as angry, militant, but there was also a lot of women who just came out of the woodwork to say, me too. I can't tell you how many times I heard those words for decades. So it's so interesting to me that that became a rallying cry more recently for women, you know, affirming each other's experience.
I played the powerless in too many dark scenes, and I was blessed with a birth and a death, and I guess I just want some say in between. Don't you understand? In the day to day or the face to face, I have to act just as strong as I can, just to preserve a place where I can be who I am. Talk to me now.
A lot of what I spoke to was the experience of being prey, you know, in a world of predators, just daily survival and negotiation of that power dynamic. And I think a lot of young women saw an experience reflected that they just hadn't seen reflected.
I am not a pretty girl. That is not what I do. I ain't no damsel in distress. And I don't need to be rescued, so put me down, punk.
I talk about in the book releasing the record Not a Pretty Girl as a turning point. It was right around then, maybe 1995, that the fanatic, the sort of frenetic energy began to escalate around me. I remember stepping out in the mid-90s on stage in a dress, and it was like I committed an atrocity to humankind. You know, just immediate cries, sell out, from the crowd. And of course, then marrying a person with a penis, you know, again, outrageous and unacceptable to some people who felt very disappointed or suddenly left out. Women in general, dykes in particular, to have lived lives of marginalization, to be searching so desperately for a place in the world. I think it meant that some people, when they found me, clung very hard, you know, and they became very demanding.
And people talk about my image like I come in two dimensions, like lipstick is a sign of my declining mind, like what I happen to be wearing. The day that someone takes a picture is my new statement for all of womankind.
But also in all of those moments were my deliverance, you know? It was, those were the moments that sustained me in other ways, you know, when when the story that someone told of how my work impacted them or someone they love or the thing that they gave me back was the fuel, you know, that I used to get up the next morning. It's ironic to me that I was on stage in front of the most amount of people at one of the low points in my personal life and feeling at home in my skin.
The sky is gray, and the sand is gray, and the ocean is gray. And I feel right at home in this stunning monochrome, alone in my way.
I smoke and at its peak, I was coming undone. In the early 2000s, I may have been stumbling, but I was about to be reborn to something else, and that thing I'm not even ready to describe.
That story was produced by Studio 360's Lauren Hansen. Ani DeFranco's memoir, No Walls and the Recurring Dream, will be out May 7th.